I'm David. I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to welcome all of you to our second anniversary meeting of the Primary Purpose Group. And we'll go ahead and get started with the readings. And Elise is going to read the preamble for us.
Hi, my name's Elise, and I'm an alcoholic. Happy birthday, Primary Purpose. I think we ought to give them a hand. Let's go ahead. I'm a new member of this group, and I'm just so happy to be a member. And so glad y'all started this group. Thank you to those that started it and kept it going. And I'll do my best to keep it going, too. This is the preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no fees or dues for membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help others achieve sobriety. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Elise. And David is going to read the 12 steps.
My name is David. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. I just love these microphones. Nominees for Best Actor are. Here are the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Happy anniversary to all of us.
All right, thank you, David. And Mark is going to read the 12 traditions.
I'm a little shorter than the rest of them. Mark, I'm an alcoholic. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, the loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, may a group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name, any related facility or outside enterprise, unless problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion, and we always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
All right, thank you, Mark. One of the reasons I asked if it'd be all right if I chair this meeting is I had like a thing or two I wanted to say, and it really amounts to thanks. You know, thank you all for being here and for being part of this group. A couple of years ago, you know, we got this thing started, and a lot of us were involved in what primary purpose means is carrying the message to those that still suffer, the detox, the prisons, that kind of thing. And And we're real active in that. And we're getting together and meeting and talking about how we could do that better. You know, and that kind of grew into a group that was about doing that. We wanted to have a place where when a new guy showed up from detox or from prison or somewhere, he stood a good chance of hearing the message that Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer, that he could walk in and find out there is a solution, a place where there's hope, where people are not just getting sober but getting better, you know, that their lives are getting better. They're getting back into their families. They're getting back into the community. We wanted a place like that where recovery was about the whole person, you know, and I think we've done that. You know, we've had a lot of good people come our way, you know. I think this year one of the things that's been the greatest thing this year is the members that have come along that are now picking up 1- and 2-year medallions, you know. That's the neatest thing, that they came in, got sober, and they're getting on with helping others. We've got people that joined us along the way that are now sponsoring other folks, and it's just been a lot of fun. I wanted to say thanks to everybody that's involved. Also, you know, it takes a lot of time and effort. I'm glad we have a lot of the family members here, because that's the other thing I wanted to talk about was thanks. We were in a meeting last night where we were talking about the amount of time it takes, you know, that you've been waiting for somebody to sober up, they do, and then they're off running around helping drunks, you know, and I know it takes a lot of time away from the family and away from things you might like to have at home, and I want to thank you all for the time you've given us, you know, by allowing your loved ones to help others and help us do what we do. It means a whole lot. I think that's all I need to say. I think I'll go ahead and let Harold introduce our speaker.
I'm Harold Alcoholic. This is tough. Mom, I look like Dad up here getting ready to cry. I met this lady, actually, when I first got sober, I got involved in corrections work, helping some guys in prison, and didn't feel like I was doing a very good job of it, but fortunately, I had the help of a lady who has been doing this for some 10, 11 years, and she's been a great help to me, and we wanted to come down here and tell her story today, so I'm not going to delay any further. Stacy.
I'm Stacy, and I'm an alcoholic. It's a privilege to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the first thing I was wondering is, what's the chances of reversing us? You know, I feel like I should be able to look at the link. It is a privilege to be here, and I'd like to thank David and Harold for inviting me and allowing me to participate in your second anniversary. I think that's awesome. A lot of groups don't make it to year two. That's pretty neat. We know that a lot of times meetings won't make it on if we're not practicing traditions and principles, and it says a lot about your group to be able to make it to year two. It really does. And this is great. The scenery is awesome, and it was a lot better than I had pictured for whatever reason. It's just, this has been wonderful, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be here with you. And what I'm supposed to do is tell you in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today, and I'll do that to the best of my ability. Growing up, I had as normal as possible childhood. There was no alcohol in my family, although there was alcoholism. My grandfather was an alcoholic, and my mother brought all kinds of neat tricks to the table growing up in an alcoholic home, and I had just about everything I ever wanted and definitely everything I ever needed, and was just raised in church and with good morals and values, and looked pretty perfect, you know. The only things that seem to be significant enough to talk about even is the first one is that I was adopted. And this was something that I carried with me a long way, well into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just could not understand, you know, why mothers give up their little girls. And I just knew that there was something wrong with me for that to happen. And my parents, who I certainly choose to call my mother and my father, the ones that adopted me, they would read me, especially my mom, she would read me the adoption book and the special chosen child book and all that stuff. And all I knew is I certainly didn't feel special or chosen, and I just didn't believe any of that stuff, you know, and I just didn't get it. I knew that, you know, wasn't normal. And like I said, I carried that long in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was actually the first way my parents got me into some type of therapy was they had suggested that as soon as a psychiatrist or a psychologist had suggested that I was emotionally and mentally capable of handling such information, then they would, you know, possibly help enable me to possibly locate and find my natural parents. And needless to say, no one ever said I was emotionally and mentally capable of handling anything, you know, much less something like that. So that never happened. But it was a way my parents manipulated me into some type of treatment and therapy. And because, you see, they didn't know what was wrong with me either from the very beginning. You know, they didn't know what was wrong with me. Just it was apparent that there was a problem. And I can remember one day I had woke up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really, really tried to figure out what it was I had done because I wanted to replicate that action. And there was nothing that I could pinpoint that I did the day before or anything to wake up to realize that y'all were my family. And that's pretty cool, you know, from years and years of therapy to being okay with who I am and the people that adopted me and loved me, you know, very much. So that was also probably my first experience of maybe realizing that there was truly a God that cared about me. I came here agnostic, and meaning that I had no knowledge of God. I was taught certain morals and values and principles, but I just didn't know. I just didn't know. And what a horrible, horrible place to be when you just don't know. Another thing, and this is crazy, I know, it makes no sense. Sometimes I feel like I just shouldn't even say it. It's so off the wall. But I had, as a kid, a fear of nuclear destruction. And I live on a 500 perimeter mile lake, and there's two huge nuclear plants. McGuire is the one closest to me, and I just, you know, if y'all can remember back in the early 70s, we're still in the Cold War with USSR, and I can remember right this second, I could see that big mushroom they'd show us on TV, and we're just all going to die gasping for air, and I just did not want to go out like that, and I just thought, I was convinced that's how we were going to die. And I remember the day they put the nuclear plants on, I mean, nuclear plants, the nuclear sirens on the road, and they tested those sirens every third month on Mondays at noon. And I thought World War III was every 3 months on Monday at noon. We were just all going to die. And I just had a terrible fear of death. And that went on and on and on and on. I grew into a whole lot of other fears and paralyzing fears, and I didn't know what that was all about. And the last thing is that is significant enough to talk about is I was a thief from the gate, stole everything, had no reason to steal anything, but I did. My dad to this day plays poker with the same old men they've been playing for about 40 years, maybe 35 years, and every Wednesday, in my reality, which is I've learned often distorted, was that if he won, the money was on top of the dresser, and if he lost, the money was in the dresser. And I have no idea where I came up with this theory all by myself, but that's why I decided. And so I started stealing the money. I'm like 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, and I have no idea what I thought I was going to buy, you know, like 10,000 candy bars or I don't know. But I just had a lot. I had a stash, and by the time I'm 9 and 10 and 11, I'm stealing out of the drugstore, chewing gum and candy. And I don't remember someone teaching me this. I don't remember seeing this. I just remember intuitively knowing that you pay for something and you steal something. I knew not to just go in there and steal it, that you had to buy something. And I don't know where this came from. It's just it was there. By the time I'm 12, I stole my first car. And sometimes I feel like I could just sit down right now, you know, because that kind of just describes how I was. And I was excitement was definitely something that I was seeking, a thrill. And I also found King Alcohol when I was 12 years old. And I knew I got somehow or another I got my hands on a half a gallon of Everclear. And I don't know why I chose Everclear. I never even heard of Everclear. I don't know. But that's what I got. And I don't know if I had two drinks or 12, but I know I felt the effects produced by alcohol enough that I absolutely knew without a shadow of a doubt that I was going to do this again as often as I could, as much as I could, as long as I could, until there was no more to drink, or until my resources were completely gone. And that's what I did until the day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. Didn't come up for air for a second. I was a social drinker, I like to say, for like 6 seconds. That was it. It was over. There was no social anything. I drank for complete oblivion. Every time I drank, for complete oblivion. And I have, you know, a lot of people in my life that seem to drink for, you know, 20 and 30 years with seemingly no consequences, you know, and that was not the case for me. I was in trouble from the very beginning with alcohol. I could have used this program at 14, honestly. Could have used it at 14. I immediately began to compromise everything. Everything in my life was compromised for alcohol. I didn't see it. I didn't see a lot until after I got sober, a whole lot. I don't even remember even thinking, but maybe just a couple of times that I might even have a problem. And you know, our book talks about that too. About half after a while, we can no longer differentiate the true from the false, and that was my experience so early that I could no longer differentiate the true from the false, and what was reality and what wasn't reality. And I was far-fetched from reality, our book says, and that describes me so perfectly. And I don't know, looking back today, and every time I tell my story, I just cannot believe, I don't know how you can be the person that I was and live the way I did and not be aware of the condition I was in. I had no idea the condition I was in the day I got sober, the day I got here, by any means. And I was taught when I first got sober is that you never ever have to be alone again unless you talk too long. So I have my watch here if anyone's concerned. So we won't go over, I promise. And there's a guy, he says, I have the watch here, but I really don't care what happened. But I care. I won't go over. So I'm by the time I'm 14, I'm a mess. I'm a mess. I'm skipping school. My parents are devastated. I'm from a real small town, Davidson, North Carolina, and everybody knows everybody. And I got caught for like everything. I did, you know. My parents would get phone calls and say, "God, Stacy's 14. She's got her license already. How'd she do that?" You know. And I'm thinking, okay, well, you need to drive after midnight, you know, and everybody's asleep. And I was just absolutely insane. It's the only word I could use. Just crazy. And the thing that alcohol did for me right away, immediately, is it numbed any feelings that I had about anything for anybody. And I think that that's what enabled me to live the way that I lived, with just not caring. I don't ever remember ever not going home and thinking, I wonder how my parents are feeling right now, you know? I wonder, you know, what they're thinking. I don't ever remember caring about how other people felt about my actions, how my actions were affecting other people. And it just baffles me that I could be so selfish and so self-centered and live that way. But that's exactly what alcohol did for me. Eventually, what happened was you know, I said that I had was a social drinker for 6 seconds, and that's honest God the truth. And I began to get to the point where alcohol, it was just, it was a daily part of my life. It was everything, absolutely everything revolved around drinking. And my parents had started, I don't even know, maybe when I was 13 years old, started going to Al-Anon and Nar-Anon and Tough Love and counseling at the church and anything and everything, trying to figure out what the problem is. And that just never, I don't remember anyone suggesting that I was an alcoholic. And they, I think maybe they felt like a lot of it was them, and if they could fix whatever was wrong with them, then maybe I would get better or something. I'm not even sure what that was all about. But they definitely took some type of responsibility, which they had absolutely no business doing, because it was all me, self-induced 100%. And I eventually got to the point where they had said that I was going to get treatment or I was going to leave, and I left. And I was like, treatment for what? I didn't see it. Didn't see it at all. And the insane thing about that is I had nowhere to go. You know, didn't bother me a bit. I just called some of my friends, and I would just go from one house to one house to hotel, and had a lot of times I felt like people were probably jealous of me because I had no curfew, and I'm homeless, you know, but I'm thinking people want to be me, really. And I kept going to school, and I was so proud of myself for going to school. I felt like I was doing something wonderful, great, that I kept going to high school. And I eventually had that taken away from me, too, because you can't live the way I lived and expect to be able to go to school. And I'll just give you a quick visual. There's my car, and I think five county cops and 7 state troopers behind it. Now, that was a scary day. So I wasn't able to finish school, and never do I remember thinking that my education has just been compromised or anything like, you know, what am I going to do about career opportunities or anything like that. I'm just like, I don't know, it was almost a relief, you know, that I didn't have to go to school anymore. And any and every avenue of financial resource was made illegally. I couldn't keep a job. I couldn't hold a job. I was really, really angry. Angry person. And I can have, y'all probably can't imagine this, but I was constantly fighting, getting kicked out of bars for fighting. I'm like 17, 18 years old, and I'm not even supposed to be drinking in there. I have fake IDs, of course, and I was kicked out of school so many times for fighting, always for fighting. You see all this, I'm not putting it together still, that there's a problem, you know, not seeing it. Now, when I was like 13, 14, 15, I don't even know how old, you know, I told you I started doing the therapy, and that eventually became a requirement to live there, that I'd have to do the family therapy every other week or something like that. We had contracts, and I'd have to sign the contract, and I just absolutely could not keep up with any contract or follow the rules. I just couldn't do it. But anyway, so I left, and I had no idea what I was getting myself into, and I had no idea, you know. I really, really had things good living with my parents, and now I'm just, I like to call myself a free spirit. I can do whatever I want, whenever I want, as long as I want, and that's what characteristic of what an alcoholic, you know, total self will run riot, and that's exactly how I live my life. I finally, I had what we call a moment of clarity, and I remember clearly right this second. I was watching these kids. I don't know why. I was just watching these don't even know where I was, but watching these kids, they're all walking in a little straight line, and they're kicking each other and biting and doing what kids do, and I thought, oh my gosh, you know, if I could be 6 years old one more time, and I wouldn't turn out like this, and I would not be on this road, and I'd be a good kid, and I'd be a good sister, and I'd go to school, and I just wouldn't be like this. And then my very next thought would be, you need a drink, you know? I've totally overreacted again. You know, I overreact all the time. And then I would go drink, and I'd be off and running 3 months before I'd even consider some different lifestyle. But I did have one, and I evidently called my parents in blackout a lot. And I'd call and say, I want help, you know? And then I'd call them back, and, you know, a month later or whatever, and they wanted to know where the help, you know, question went to. And I'm like, for what? You know, still not putting it together. I had another one of these moments of clarity, and I had done what I needed to do to pass. I told my parents I had been clean and sober for 3 months. And it's the only time I'll mention it, I kind of have to at this point. I did do every drug there is under the sun except for like one that I can think of. But this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't talk about that here out of respect out for the traditions. But I have to say it at this point because I had agreed to take a drug test and a breathalyzer at any time, any hour, if they just please let me come home. And I realized today what happened was I ran out of resources, and I was tired of running for just a minute, and I needed to go rest up for a second. And I had the same choices, the therapy and the, you know, and I can't live up to that. I think I lasted. I'm not sure. These are the things I don't even ask my parents about today, but I think I lasted like 40 days or something before I was caught. And I can remember one time going and taking one of these tests, and they didn't even ask me to. I just figured I'd go take it so I could go get drunk, you know, and that made sense to me that I would go and that they would think they'd be proud of me for volunteering this test. And can you imagine? The doctor is one of my dad's best friends, and I just show up at the doctor's office. I mean, what an embarrassment. I was saying, I want to take a drug test, and just total insanity. So this last time, so I left. The choices are always the same, to get help or leave, and I left again. And this time, things were considerably different. I never like talking about this part of my story, because, you know, that third, so there's a promise, the ninth step promises, about how we don't regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. And that's my toughest one, my very, very toughest one, because there's some things I'd do different. You better believe it. There's some things I would not have done, things I would change if I could. And I'm not talking about robbing people or robbing places or any of these horrible things like that I did, or getting caught with $30,000 of hot firearms. I like to sell hot guns, stolen guns. I thought that would be a good way to make a living. I'm talking about things that just won't go away sometimes, you know, like physically hurting my mother. You know, because I'm just coming unglued, and I need a drink. Things like that are hard to forget about, or to be able to sit here and say that I don't regret everything. I'm trying to run down and kill my father in a car in total blackout. I don't remember any of it. And then for them to have to tell me stuff like this, and that stuff still hurts.
and I compromised every moral and value I ever had for a drink and to live the lifestyle that I lived. And Harold, I am so much worse than you. I'm such a baby. I'm sorry. So when I tell you that for me to be sober today, that it's a privilege to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, gosh, that's an understatement. You know, I ended up, I'll just say that, get sober, I ended up in an institution in Louisiana, and I was there for almost my first year of sobriety. And it was good for me. It's what I needed. I needed to be told what to do, when to do it, how long to do it. It was not a DOC facility, a Department of Corrections facility. It was like an alternative. I don't know if you have a place here in South Carolina like this, but it was like an alternative to jail for a lot of people. And the bottom line is that there was a whole bunch of fruitcakes up in there, and I was one of them, you know, right there in the middle. We were all so crazy, and we weren't all alcoholics. We had every kind of disorder you can think of. You know, we were just all crazy. That's what we had in common. And I was there, you know, my first year, and when I left there, I didn't know what to do or where I was going to go or, once again, where I was going to sleep. And it was the first time in my life ever do I remember not having Plan B. I'd always had Plan B. But I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went to a meeting, and I just did what I'm doing right now. I cried and cried and cried and cried. And I told those people I didn't know what I was going to do or where I was going to go. And I want y'all to know I didn't stay one night on the streets. And back then, before I got sober, I never knew of the homeless shelters and the soup kitchens, and I had never even heard of places like that, which is a good thing, because that would have carried me a long way, I guarantee it. But I didn't have to stay in any of those places. A lady took me in the very first night, and her name was Donna, or is Donna, and she taught me a lot of things. And the first thing is she said that this is the fellowship here at this meeting. This is the fellowship, and she showed me the big book, and she said, this is the program. There's two different Alcoholics Anonymouses, and you need to know the difference. And that was good for me, because she told me that the fellowship was only going to carry me so far, and that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that's outlined in the big book was going to be the thing that saved my life. And that was vital information for somebody like me. And she also told me that we read the big book with a dictionary. And that was good for me, too, because I told you I didn't finish high school. There's some really big words in the big book. And Bill was smart. He used 10 different words. They all mean the same thing, you know. And I'm thinking it was a hard place to be, because I didn't want to tell you that I didn't know what they meant and da 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 da. So she made it easy for me and just said, we're going to look up all the words that we have any questions about. And that's how I studied the book. On Wednesday, the first Wednesday that we went out, that I was out of there, she took me to jail, to a meeting. And, you know, I was a little hesitant. I was thinking, here we go again, basically, you know, and didn't really want to go, and didn't know what to expect. And she didn't ask me, would you be interested in service work or anything like that? She just said, get in the car, we're going. And we ended up in jail. And I just thought that's where the meetings were. That's where, I didn't know. And people come on a different night, perhaps. I didn't know. And I loved it. And it amazed me, those ladies been there forever, and they just seemed to be okay, just okay with where they were and who they were. And it was a pretty, pretty awesome experience, my first meeting in jail. And I just kept doing what she said, whatever she'd say. And I tell you, it took me about 3 months before I had my own place to live and a car and a job. And I mean, things went uphill really, really fast for me. And I just had all kinds of good things happen really, really fast. And I was just neck deep in Alcoholics Anonymous, just running everywhere. And then my sponsor put me on the 12-step call list in Louisiana. I'm still in Louisiana at this point. And so people would call in and for help, and I'd go and try to get somebody sober. And it was an awesome beginning. After like 3 months, I told you I had my own place, and then after a while, I don't know how long after that, I met this guy Bubba in a meeting, and Bubba just got out of the penitentiary. I thought, well, okay, this will be good. Bubba doesn't have a place to live, so I had a bedroom, and I wanted to rent out a bedroom because I was just so poor, y'all, poor. And I wanted to rent out a bedroom, so I did that. And Bubba worked offshore in Louisiana. A lot of guys, they work offshore, and they'll be gone the whole time, and you get all their money, you know. It's like perfect. And I could live by myself like I wanted to, but get half the bills paid, you know. I mean, it was a perfect setup. And so that lasted. We just had the best time, and strictly platonic deal. And I'd drag him on these 12-step calls, and he was newly sober as well, and even more so than me. And we'd go on all these 12-step calls in the middle of the night, and I'd like to bring, for some reason, I like old drunk men, and like old, and the ones that like live under the bridge and haven't taken a bath in like 3 months, and that's the kind of drunks I like. And I would get them, and I would put them in my backyard, and I'd steal lounge chairs from apartment complexes and put them back there, and feed them mustard and cheese sandwiches and lemonade. And every last one of them would eat mustard and cheese sandwiches and lemonade. And I did that so many times, I can't tell you. I never got anybody sober. But I tried and tried and tried. And this one guy, well, two, really, I worked with for a long, I mean, like a year, you know, I did everything wrong. You know, they called drunk 4 o'clock in the morning. I'd go pick them up, bring them back, and put them in the lounge chair. And they would never bathe. I could never get them to bathe. I never understood that. They would just didn't want to. And this one guy, he would go to Texas and come back, and he could run and catch a train. Was going. He's good. And he'd come back with food stamps and jewelry. And I don't know where he got these, but he'd always have all these, like, five necklaces around his neck. And, he had a beard down to here and food stamps. So, I never saw him again, but there was this one guy, another guy, and he was sitting outside my home group one night, and he was drinking out of a paper bag, and he was sitting on the curb, and I'd talk to him, and then the next week he was there, and the next week he was there. And then I think it was the third week I had said, you know, he had a buddy with him that time. And I said, well, why don't y'all come in here and drink some coffee and get some cookies, because it was cold. And I made everybody mad, because I got these two drunks, you know, in there. And I'm like, here's my new friends. I want y'all to meet my friends, you know. And everybody's pissed off because they're trying to have a meeting, you know, and I got these drunks that are obnoxious, and I didn't know that wasn't the way to do it, but I was trying to make them feel at home, and, you know, but anyway, I got a book sent to me 5 years later from one of those drunk guys, and he had wrote some things on the inside of that meditation book to let me know he was sober, and that was so cool. God had that work out just the way it was supposed to, because if I was still there, then I would have maybe thought that I actually had something to do with it, you know. But it was after I had moved to Baton Rouge, and he had got sober. And the last I heard, he was about 4 or 5 years sober and had a job and a car, and I can't even picture him that way. And, you know, I just can't even picture him. But anyway, that's what I did all the time. I just loved it. I was a waitress. I lived by dollar to dollar, and was just having a great time. Well, Bubba went offshore, and I met Troy, which is Bubba's brother. Long story short, 2 years later, I had a little girl, and she, by far, has been absolutely the greatest gift that God has ever trusted me with, is this child. And she's an AA baby for sure. And she went to her first convention when she was 30 days old, and she loves AA. She knows as much about Alcoholics Anonymous, I feel like, as I do, and she's never heard my talk, and I won't let her, whenever I go somewhere, I won't let her go with me if I'm talking. I just, she doesn't know me like that, you know, as that person. And I told her when she's 18, maybe 20, but she's awesome. And Girls Off sponsor will call and she'll say, "Did you go to a meeting today?" And she likes to give out chips, you know, and like before or after the meeting, you know. And she's just great. When I was about 5 years sober, I moved back to North Carolina, and what had happened I didn't really realize is that I had never really been too successful at distinguishing love and lust and that type of thing. And so that deal with her dad didn't work out, and it was kind of just like alcohol, you know, unable to differentiate the truth from the false until you're like a year later and you're like, "What are you doing?" And unfortunately, that was the experience. And I was trying to get better, and he wasn't. And things just don't work out like that. And so I came back to North Carolina, and the first thing that was apparent to me is that I was going to have to learn to take care of myself, because I just did not have a lot of volunteers. And I decided I'd get my, we call in Charlotte, my good enough degree, my GED. And I did that. And my entire family nearly has advanced degrees, apart from me. They all went to Alabama, University of Alabama, but me. And I was, you know, feeling pretty less than for a lot of years. And so I did that, and I just didn't learn anything. My guidance counselor, my history teacher, and two or three members of the administrative staff in my high school were my biggest clients for the business that I ran. I didn't learn anything in school, anything. And but I was able to get that GED, and then I went to a community college for a couple of years, and I got a degree there. And then I got to go to UNCC, and I got a couple degrees there, and that's a long way from homeless, y'all, you know. And what I found out is that I can do and go absolutely anywhere I want to go, as long as I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, that any and all my dreams can come true. And it didn't matter how smart I was or how smart I wasn't. I made A's in, like, statistics. And who knows statistics, right? Can you believe that? I mean, it was just about me being willing to do something about my life, just being willing to show up. And I never really knew that I could, and I say I, that me and God could do that type of thing together. And it was really hard, though, because the whole time I was on food stamps and welfare and Medicaid and everything that I was embarrassed about and despised about people I felt like were using the system and things like that. And it was horrible, because I'm thinking, you know, I know how to make a dollar. It's not like this. And trying to remember that we can't live the way we used to live, if we're going to keep what God's given us today, you know, can't live, you can't break the law, that's what I'm trying to say. So I don't know how I did it. I swear I don't. My sponsor would just tell me to put one foot in front of the other and suit up and show up and keep helping the next person and make your bed. It used to make me mad, make my bed. Why do I have to make my bed? I didn't understand what that had anything to do with anything. And I understand today that when my house is clean, I feel clean. That makes sense. And the other thing when I moved back here was I found a jail right away, Mecklenburg County Jail, and I started taking me. I started going to a whole lot of prisons and just wherever I could be of service. And it's not for everybody, but it's what I do well. And today I go to Albemarle Correctional, and it's a maximum security gun camp, and I just love it. I love that meeting. There's five women's prisons in the state of North Carolina, and there's 75 men's prisons. So my opportunity to carry a message to women in prison is a 6-hour trip. So I don't take that commitment. So I do the women's jails, but I do the men's prisons, and those guys are just awesome. And I tell you what, you just can't have a lot of problems when you go to a place like that, you know, and you just leave there, and oh my gosh, I'm certain that I can't say I wouldn't be sober, because I don't know that, but I know I wouldn't have the quality of life that I have today if I didn't go to places like that. And these people, I mean, you know, I don't just go to help them. I mean, they help me, you know, they help me so much. And, you know, I'll give you an example. A couple of years ago, I went to a meeting, and one of my guys, he's like, "What is wrong with you?" You know, evidently it was pretty clear that I'd had a bad day, and that's all I needed, because I let him know, you know, and blah, 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 telling him all these things. And he just said, "Look at this." He said, "I've been in here 29 years, and look how locked up you are and how free I am." And he turned around and walked off, and I was so mad. I wanted to cuss him out. I thought, well, he's been here 29 years for something, you know. I'm not going to make this man too mad, you know, and but what a message, huh? What a message that he's a free person. And I really paid attention to him, and he'd talk about being in two prisons when he got sober, and now he just lives in one. And I thought, well, that's about all, you know, that's all of us, I guess. You know, we make our own prison, and that's self-imposed restrictions. Another guy, Henry, he was in for 25 years, and he's out, and he's one of my very, very best friends. And who would have ever thought, you know? And he's gotten, in the last year, he's gotten married, and his wife's having a baby, and he's gotten a promotion at his job. And I've been able to watch this man who's got 10,000 felonies become a productive member of society, and it just doesn't get better than that, you know. It's a pretty cool feeling. And my daughter's had strep throat twice in the last month, and somebody told the guy she was sick. I didn't tell him, and somebody told. And I got there, and I had a homemade get well card, and like 75 guys all signed it, and they remember my birthday every year, and my regular birthday, my belly button birthday, you know, not just my AA birthday. And there's a huge, huge part of my life, and I just don't know, and I don't need to know why I've been so blessed to be able to accept the God's grace in my life. And, you know, this guy, Bubba, became Amber. My daughter's name is Amber. Became Uncle Bubba, right? So he's Amber's favorite uncle. And he was in and out of AA, in and out of prison, in and out. And he could never get it together. And I was sponsoring this great grandma And I never understand why this great-grandma wanted me to sponsor her, you know. And we had nothing. It didn't seem like, I don't know how I was going to, we just lived completely different lives, you know. And, but I was taught you never say no, ever, 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 ever. And so I could pick her up. She didn't drive, you know. I could pick her up, bring her to AA and stuff. And her daughter was murdered. And I went to court with her every day. We'd go to court, and I tell you what, you talk about powerless. That was a new experience because, you know, we like to be able to help people or at least say something. And I had absolutely nothing to say that was going to make the situation any better, you know. Like, it's okay, this too shall pass. You know, no, this was not going to be okay, you know. I mean, it was a new experience. I just didn't know what to do. And, what happened about 6 months later is Uncle Bubba was murdered. And every time I think I'm helping somebody, they seem to be helping me, you know, because she taught me how to put one foot in front of the other, and you don't drink no matter what, and you just keep going. And and that's what we did. And Amber didn't understand why she couldn't say goodbye. Or of course, she doesn't know what happened. She just, her father had told her that he was in a car wreck, and I just left it at that. And but she didn't understand. And we would do a lot of things, like we'd bury notes, you know, and they'd go to heaven that way. And we'd get balloons and tie messages, and we did that for a real long time. And the two things that I know that I've done right is I haven't picked up a drink yet since April 28th, 1991. And I try at any time to help somebody. Now, absolutely everything else is questionable. but I've done those two things pretty good, I think. And I sponsor a lot of people, and I'm absolutely in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. It has not changed my life. It's given me a life, and I just absolutely didn't have one before. I had one of those deals I wasn't even allowed on my parents' property because I was breaking and entering, and I had my license taken when I was like 16 and a half. They were gone or something. I don't even know. Maybe 17, and I was going to get my license back, and I needed my birth certificate, so I decided in my logic that I needed to break in my parents' house to get my birth certificate. And I guarantee you my parents would have given me my birth certificate, but this is, you know, the sense I'm making out of this is that I just need to break in. So they were none too pleased with me, and I was not ever allowed on the property. I mean, this is the condition I left to go to Louisiana. You know, I burned them time and time again, over and over again, broken promises. And today, my dad calls me every day, like 6 o'clock in the morning, every day. My mom, I talk to her about every other day. I'm good with that, every other day. I'm a daddy's girl. And we have the best relationship. You just wouldn't believe it. We have absolutely the best relationship. And they're just such a big part of my daughter's life. And it's just awesome. It's such a good deal. But I will tell you, it took me five years, long years, to build trust back with my family. And we get sober and we think we've done something miraculous and we want to be congratulated, and all we're doing is acting like a normal person, you know? And so it took a long time to be able to, for them to trust me. I could go on forever and tell you what AA has done for me. My daughter Amber and I is still just me and her, and the neat thing is that God's enabled us to have everything that a two parent family would have, and we're really lucky. I've learned to be financially responsible We own a house, and I've got two cars, and all of those things that it says that things will materialize if we work for them, you know? And that's happened for me. I have an awesome job. A couple of weeks ago, I was in a meeting with all these big wigs and these vice presidents, and I'm thinking, they have no idea. I have them all so fooled, you know, if they only knew. And I'm thinking, what am I doing here with these people, you know? And it's just crazy that I have just been able to have this life this way. It's just, it's a privilege to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It truly is. And I'm gonna sit down now. Because like I said, I could go on forever, but I know y'all are ready to go. And thanks again for inviting me. I really appreciate the opportunity to celebrate with you, and God bless.
I thought you were gonna close this thing out, Harold. Okay. We like to close by remembering the 12th tradition long form. And finally, we of Alcoholics Anonymous believe the principle of anonymity has an immense spiritual significance. It reminds us that we are to place principles before personalities, that we are to actually practice a genuine humility. This to them, that our great blessings may never spoil us, that we shall forever live in thankful contemplation of him who presides over us all. And those who would, help us close with the Lord's Prayer.